I want to talk about Madame Bovary, kind of in the nature, I guess, of a book review, really. Some of you have read it, I assume, and some maybe haven't. Is that a fair assumption? Nobody's saying anything, but I assume that's probably fair. Okay. So I kind of wanted to maybe turn people on to reading it or rereading it, because I think it's one of the great books. I said that about Tolkien. I keep slipping all these great books into the top 10 of my list, and Madame Bovary is in the top 10. Some people asked me what the other day what my top 10 was, and every time I mention the list, I slip something new. But I think War and Peace has to be pretty close to the top of books for me, personally. I would put Tolkien's Lord of the Rings in the top 10 books of the world for me. I'd put Madame Bovary in there. I would put Sholokhov's books, Quiet Flows the Don, The Don Flows Home to the Sea. Really outstanding books by a very talented Russian writer. And I think I would put Scarlet Letter in there for me. It's always been a tremendous book. And after that, I kind of lose count. I don't even get up to 10. I put Canterbury Tales in there and some other odds and ends, oddments. But this book certainly took, he wrote on it for 5 years, and a very famous line that I know a lot of you have heard, 1 week, 2 pages, he wrote to a friend. So if some of you are writers or want to write and have trouble getting into it, take heart from Flaubert. 1 week, 2 pages. He literally almost chained himself to his desk to work on this book. It's a story. Simply, I guess if you can say anything like this, is simple, about a triangle, a love affair that Emma had. In fact, this is it. I'll just read you the synopsis. A young woman married to a dull country doctor and possessed of worldly and sensual romantic longings takes a lover and is deserted by him, takes a second lover, falls hopelessly into debt, and finally resorts to arsenic. A simple tragedy to be enacted within the constricting limits of a Norman bourg or small market town with its priest and its chemist, its agricultural show, and its incurable bourgeoisdom. Now that's a story, and nothing could be duller than a story about the eternal triangle. But what Flaubert does with it is remarkable. He introduces Emma Bovary in one of the most remarkable characters in all of literature. And what I've done was circle some pages, some passages to read to you, because I think it's the best way to talk about literature, for me anyway, is to let the literature talk, say itself. What anybody can finally say about a work of literature has got to be second to the literature itself. And I probably won't have time, because I fell in love with the book all over again while I was getting ready, and I have about 2 pages of things to read, and I obviously can't do that. So I'll start anyway. Charles Bovary, growing up in France. In fact, on our tour, we were zipping by northern France in the bus, and I was kind of dozing, looking out the window, and I saw this sign, Rouen, 8 kilometers, and I just about jumped out of the bus, because that's where this is from. And I didn't stop, of course. It's one of those, you can't ask 42 other people to wait while I go up there and look around, but I would have liked to. Well, Charles Bovary, Flaubert says, by dint of steady work, he always kept about the middle of his class. That's our hero, Charles Bovary. By dint of steady work, he always kept about the middle of his class. That's kind of damning with faint praise, and Flaubert is a master at that. He's a master of a couple of things. First of all, his language is very poetic. One of the things he wanted to do was write a realistic novel about people he detested, in a very poetic way, and that's undertaking a great deal. He didn't like the bourgeois folk, people who were, he thought, were dull, were commonplace, were petty, materialistic, niggling, all that he just detested with a passion. In fact, he detested it so much that finally one person said, why do you hate these people so much? They don't seem so bad, they're kind of common. He said, that's what I hate about them, they're too common, can't stand them. And his friend looked at him in a searching way, and Flaubert looked back at him, and Flaubert says, yeah, you're right, I see what you mean. Madame Bovary, c'est moi. I am Madame Bovary. And he realized that he hated this materialistic, niggling, petty, material, groping stuff in other people, he realized it was in himself. That's why I like to teach Madame Bovary to my college students and watch the light shock of recognition come on when they realize they are Emma Bovary or they are Charles Bovary. And I teach Babbitt and Main Street and Elmer Gantry for the same reason, because Babbitt and Elmer Gantry are such really loathsome characters on one side. On the other side, they're so funny and so full of life and such great guys, you don't know whether to hate Elmer Gantry or just wish you were in his congregation. He's such a loudmouth and such an oaf, and yet he does so much good in funny ways that you don't know what to make of him. That's why I like Sinclair Lewis. Well, back to Charles. His mother wants him to be a doctor, and he can't. He, like me, he got D's in algebra in high school, and there's no way he's going to be a doctor, but he does become a doctor. But he skips classes in medical school. He's not a good student. He says he acquired a habit of going to the pubs and a passion for dominoes. That's Charles Bovary. Anybody who has a passion for dominoes is a certain kind of person. Flaubert drops these little bombs on these people and just kind of destroys them with a little stroke, or else pulls the rug out from under them. And he keeps us from getting very close to Charles, and we sympathize with him. We even sympathize with Emma, although she's really a bad gal in many ways. And just when you want to get close to her, Flaubert pulls the rug. He creates a tremendous lot of distance between the people by the satire. But he does it very gently by saying he acquired a habit of going to the pubs and a passion for dominoes. He has this one thing juxtaposed against another all through the book. Charles has a passion for going to the pubs and for dominoes. Later on, Emma Bovary has an affair with Monsieur Léon, a young man studying for law. And they're sitting in his rooms in Rouen, and where she has gone to learn to play the piano. Poor Charles is such a dolt, he never realizes that she's no better now after 6 months of lessons. She's going into Rouen once or twice a week to meet Leon, and she comes back, and Charles will say, play me a song, Emma, and she'll go over to the piano and just stumble along, and it never occurs to him that these lessons aren't doing any good. Well, obviously, she's not taking lessons. But anyway, she's in the rooms with Leon, and he's sitting at her feet, and she has her nightgown on, and he's kind of rubbing her finger over the lace of her petticoat. He says he admired the lace of her petticoat and her soul. That's the same kind of thing that he does, the passion for pubs and dominoes. And Emma is such an incurable romantic that she got all psyched up over reading some Sir Walter Scott and listening to very romantic operas, Lucia de Lammermoor. Everything was lived hyper up here. And she says one spot where she gets so worked up, she didn't know whether she wanted to die or live in Paris. Couldn't make up her mind. It's that kind of thing that Flaubert does maybe better than any other author. Shows the person's real personality by placing these things in juxtaposition with each other. Well, after a while he settled down and did make his rounds and become a doctor. And he learnt rhymes by ear and sang them to his female companions. He took lessons in making punch and finally in making love. There's that juxtaposition again. He meets Emma. His mother sees to it that he gets through medical school and sees to it that he gets married. And it was not enough to have brought up a son, given him a medical training, and then discovered toasts for his practice. He must have a wife as well. She found him one, a bailiff's widow from Dieppe, 45 years of age, 50 pounds of income. Though she was ugly, thin as a lath, with as many pimples as the spring has buds, yet Madame Dubuque had undeniably no lack of suitors. To attain her ends, Charles' mother was obliged to cut them all out, foiling with particular ingenuity the designs of a pork butcher backed by the clergy. It's that kind of brilliant satire that he just drops in there without elaborating it, I think makes this a very funny book. Once in a while, I must admit my freshmen usually do not share my enthusiasm for this book. And I read something like that, she foils the designs of a pork butcher backed by the clergy. I think that's a tremendously funny passage, and sometimes my freshmen wonder why I think that's funny. And but I teach it anyway. It's my class. They jolly well have to listen. Charles, as a young doctor, goes out to set a leg. He's not a very good doctor. Remember, he almost flunked out. But he can do small things, and he goes out to a farm in Les Berteaux, outside his village, and Flaubert describes it this way, a little foreshadowing. The ruts grew deeper as they were approaching Les Berteaux. The youngster slipped through a hole in the hedge to reappear at the entrance to the farmyard, open the gate. The horse slipped on wet grass. Charles ducked down to avoid the branches. The watchdogs barked in their kennels, tugging at their chains. As he entered Les Berteaux, his horse took fright and went down on all fours. Flaubert does a good deal of that foreshadowing. All the bad things as he goes into this farm, because at this farm he meets Emma, who's going to be his future wife. And his horse slips, and the branch comes back and whacks him in the face, and he gets mud on his new boots, and all these kinds of things that looking back, you'd say those were signs, should stay out. But at the time, of course, you don't look at those kinds of things. And Flaubert likes to pile these little things up. And when you look back at the novel, you can see where he was in bad shape right off the bat. He meets Emma. He sets the leg. The fracture was a simple one, luckily for Charles, with no complication of any kind. Charles could not have hoped for anything easier. Remembering his instructor's bedside manner, he comforted the injured man with a variety of bright remarks. The surgeon's blandishments, oil for his lancet, as it were. And he meets Emma, the daughter of the man who has a broken leg. Her hands were not beautiful, not pale enough perhaps, somewhat hard at the knuckles, too long as well, with no soft curving contours. Her beauty was in her eyes, brown eyes. Interestingly enough, 100 pages later, he remarks about her blue eyes. So even a guy who takes 5 years can forget what color his heroine's eyes were. But made to look black by their dark lashes, eyes that came to meet yours openly with a bold candor. Now that's Emma. Charles, remember, is married to Madame Dubuc. Her cheeks were like rosy apples. She carried a pair of tortoiseshell eyeglasses attached in masculine fashion to 2 buttonholes in her bodice. He's entranced by Emma already. See, there's a nice little piece of description, if I can find it here. Are you looking for anything, she asked? My whip, if you please. He's starting to leave the house now. He started ferreting about on the bed, behind the doors, under the chairs. It had slipped down between the wheat sacks and the wall. Mademoiselle Emma saw it and reached over for it. Charles sprang to her aid, and as he stretched out his arms in a light movement, he felt his chest brush against the girl's back, bending beneath him. She got up red in the face and looked at him over her shoulder as she handed him the lash. Instead of returning 3 days later, as he promised, he went back to Les Berteaux the very next day, and twice a week after that. And, of course, his wife at home gets a little nervous about that, wondering what he's doing out there all the time. Flaubert has another thing he does with language. He will go on very poetically telling the story and build up quite a bit of description. And then just wham, he brings things to a conclusion. When you think he ought to be at the very moment of expanding what he's saying, he does it very quickly. An example would be Charles' first wife dies. She catches a cold, so the damage had been done. A week later, as she was hanging out washing in the yard, she had a spasm and spat blood. And on the following day, as Charles was drawing the curtains, his back turned to her, she exclaimed, "Oh God," heaved a sigh, and fell unconscious. She was dead. It was incredible. That's it. That's all he devotes to that. Just bam, she was dead. It was incredible. Just the very technique of doing that creates another distance. Because he doesn't draw it out, doesn't become sentimental. And you're not ever sure how you're to approach Charles or Emma because of this distance. He keeps you away from them. You can't like them completely. You can't dislike them completely. At times you think you ought to laugh at them, and other times you think there have never been 2 more stupid people. And Flaubert really works very hard at creating this distance between these people. Well, Emma, they're now Charles is free, and Emma snaps him up like that. And incurable romantic that she is. She was raised in a convent, and her idea of religion is listening to the nuns at prayer, watching the incense float from the candles up through the stained glass rose windows, reading secret romance novels that she is secreted in, and listening to watching the nuns wind their way down these paths. This is her idea of religion. It's all very romanticized. She didn't have any real religion or faith to speak of. It was all the romantic things on the periphery of religion. So when she gets married to Charles, she says, I'd like a midnight wedding. And Charles, you remember, is just dull Charles. He says, a midnight wedding? She says, yes, in an abandoned farmhouse with candles. And Charles doesn't know how to handle this. This is something brand new. He can't fathom anybody wanting to stay up for any reason at midnight, let alone go out into the countryside in an abandoned farmhouse to get married by candles. But he does it, and so they're off and running on their wedding. And Emma is almost immediately wondering to herself, is this what marriage is really all about? I mean, just immediately she's disillusioned, because she lives up here in the ether somewhere, not down on the ground. And Charles takes her back to his house, and there, up to her room, and there is his first wife's bouquet, the wedding bouquet still there. He's such a dullard that he didn't even think to get rid of that. So Emma sees that and wonders if his next wife will see hers still sitting there. So there are all kinds of little foreshadowing things that Flaubert drops to let you know this is not going to work out. And it certainly is not going to work out. See, before the wedding, she had believed herself in love, but not having obtained the happiness that should have resulted from that love, she now fancied that she must have been mistaken. And Emma wondered exactly what was meant in life by the words bliss, passion, ecstasy, which had looked so beautiful in books. See, Emma reads books and reads things about bliss, passion, ecstasy, and naturally she expected marriage to be like that. And the first 2 weeks proved to her it wasn't going to happen. So she took that as proof that she wasn't in love. Does that sound familiar? Okay. That's exactly what Flaubert was hoping for, of course, that it might sound, it's a little fact so familiar that it might hurt a little bit, a little twinge. It's easy to sit and read a book like this and say, well, what a stupid girl she is. And a little nagging voice in the back of you saying, oh, I remember thinking that too. Maybe it took longer than 2 weeks, maybe it took 48 hours. Or whatever, but it's that kind of thing that Flaubert is banking on. Well, here's a scene now. They're married, and Charles is starting off in his rounds, goes downstairs, gets on his horse, and goes off to visit his sick patients. Down below, Charles buckled on the spurs, resting his foot on the mounting block. She went on talking to him from up above, biting off a fragment of flower or leaf and blowing it down to him. It fluttered and floated and turned semicircles in the air like a bird, and before it reached the ground, got caught up in the bedraggled mane of the old white mare standing stock still at the door. There's Charles trying to get off, and she's doing this very romantic thing of, you know, kissing a little thing and blows down, and it gets caught in the old dirty mane of the mare. It's that juxtaposition again that keeps you at a distance. If she had taken her handkerchief and kissed it and wafted it down to him, and he had reached up cavalierly, grabbed it and tied it on his neck, and gone off on a gallop, that'd be one thing, but the fact that it gets tangled up in the muddy mane of the mare, and he doesn't even see it, that's reality. And that's what happens. And Charles, of course, wouldn't know how to handle it anyway. Charles mounted, blew her a kiss. She waved an answer and shut the window. He set off along the high road, stretching away before him in an endless ribbon of dust, through sunken lanes of overhanging trees, down paths knee-deep in springing corn, with the sun on his back and the morning air in his nostrils, his heart full of the joys of the night. He rode along in peace of mind and bodily content, ruminating on his good fortune like one who continues to savor the taste of the truffles while he digests his dinner. See, Charles is very happy. He thinks he's just got it made, and he's got the best of all possible worlds. And I'm afraid Emma doesn't agree. Emma, talking again about her convent life and the way she romanticized everything. Accustomed to the peaceful, she turned in reaction to the picturesque. She loved the sea only for its storms. Green foliage only when it was scattered amid ruins. It was necessary for her to derive a sort of personal profit from things. She rejected as useless whatever did not minister to her heart's immediate fulfillment. being of a sentimental rather than an artistic temperament, in search of emotion, not of scenery. So you see, even in her literature, her religion, and now in her marriage, she's looking at the romantic side, not the realistic side, and when she doesn't find that, she's disappointed. And of course, she continues to be disappointed. And she reads books. They're about love and lovers, damsels in distress, swooning in lonely lodges, postillions slaughtered all along the road, horses ridden to death on every page, gloomy forests, troubles of the heart, vows, sobs, tears, kisses, rowing boats in the moonlight, nightingales in the grove, gentlemen brave as lions and gentle as lambs, too virtuous to be true, invariably well-dressed and weeping like fountains. That's what she's been reading, and now she's married to Charles. Poor Charles, who likes nothing better than to have a nice dinner and drinks lots of cider, pats his stomach and emits a small but tasty belch, and says, "Any dessert?" And poor Emma is just sitting there kind of toying with her plate with her fork and says yes, and she claps her hand, and the maid brings out some dessert. Charles eats the dessert, says, "A little more cider," another belch, pats his stomach again, says, "Well, Emma." And she says, "Well, Charles?" He says, "Yes." And he rocks back and forth a little bit. "Good dinner." And it goes on like this for as long as she can stand it, and she rushes out of the room in tears, and Charles says to his friend, the chemist, "I wonder what's wrong with Emma." And the chemist, of course, who is Flaubert just destroys the chemist. His name is Monsieur Homais. Homais says, "I think she needs physic." And Charles says, "Probably so. I'll speak to her in the morning." And they proceed to get a domino game going, light their pipes, and falling asleep. And Emma's upstairs looking out the window of the sun setting over the fields, wondering where the white charger is going to, when that's going to come to carry her out of this. And then the next night, the same thing. He comes home. "Well," belch. "Well, Emma." She can't take this conversation anymore. She wants all these things. She's reading the books. And Charles didn't read those books. See? He's living a good, decent, hard-working life. He's very proud of his wife and very proud of her cooking and just very proud of the whole thing. But she can't stand any of it. So they finally, they get invited to a ball. And Emma just comes alive. And Charles says, "Of course we can't go." And she says, "What do you mean we can't go? Of course we're going to go." And it means staying there overnight. So they go to this fancy ball out at a big estate in France. And she's got has some new gowns for the occasion. And let's see, Emma had never seen champagne, let alone tasted it. She's drinking all these good things. Emma dressed with the meticulous care of an actress making her debut. She did her hair in the style her hairdresser had recommended and put on her muslin dress, which had been laid out on the bed. Charles' trousers were too tight for him around his stomach. "And these straps will be awkward for dancing," he said. "Dancing," said Emma. "Yes. Why, you must be off your head. They'd laugh at you. You stay in your seat. It's not quite the thing for a doctor to dance anyhow," she said. So she goes out and is asked to dance by these gay young blades in the dance hall, and poor Charles sits there. Emma is just dancing up a storm around these... He tries to give her a kiss before they go out of the room. Charles came to kiss her on the shoulder. "Let me alone," she said. "You'll rumple me." Charles just kind of puts his hands in his pocket and shuffles along. Here's a great, brilliant description of men that she meets at the ball. The men had the complexion of wealth, that clear white skin which is accentuated by the pallor of porcelain, the shimmer of satin, the finish on handsome furniture, and is maintained at its best by a modest diet of the most exquisite foods. Their necks moved freely in low cravats, their long side whiskers rested upon turned-down collars, the handkerchiefs with which they wiped their lips were embroidered with large monograms and emitted a delicious scent. The older among them retained a youthful air, while the young ones revealed a certain maturity. Their nonchalant glances reflected the quietude of passions daily gratified. Behind their gentleness of manner, one could detect that peculiar brutality inculcated by dominance in not over-exacting activities, such as exercise strength and flatter vanity, the handling of thoroughbreds, and the pursuit of wantons. Brilliant description of these guys. And you can just see them in your mind's eye. Very full of ennui, and always resting against something, and heavy-lidded. In fact, I think it was the BBC did a brilliant thing of Madame Bovary in four installments. You may have seen it on educational TV. If you haven't and you see it listed reruns, be sure and see it. It's just remarkable. Brilliant portrayal of Emma and Charles. So she dances, and Charles finally staggers over with his tight shoes and his tight pants and says, Charles dragged himself. Oh, he had been standing upright by the whist tables for 5 hours on end, watching the play without knowing what it was all about. And it was a deep sigh of relief that he pulled off his boots and went to bed. So poor Charles is so dull that he even watches a card game for 5 hours and can't quite make it out. Can't quite figure out how it's done. And he is, you know, his mind's just not there. And Emma, of course, is all there. She's fascinated by the old Duke. He's, I think, 93 years old. And he's slobbering in his soup, and his little pigtail keeps getting in his wine, and there's two or three servants behind him to kind of, he mumbles for a dish, and they'll give him the dish, and he kind of slurps in his mouth, and just gross at the head of the table. But she's fascinated with him because he has lain in the bed of Marie Antoinette. That's the rumor in his younger days. And this, of course, this just enthralls Emma, because she's still hoping for some kind of magical romance to happen in her life. It hasn't happened yet. Here's what Charles does. Charles trotted across country in rain and snow. He ate omelets at farmhouse tables, poked his arm into damp beds, let blood and caught the warm spurt of it in his face, listened to death rattles, examined basins, tucked in a great many dirty sheets. But every evening he came home to a blazing fire and supper waiting, to a comfortable chair and a neat, attractive wife, with a fresh fragrance that made you wonder where it came from and whether it wasn't her skin that scented her petticoat. And he's happy with that. He's got a good practice built up. But Emma, poor thing, just can't stand this, and she's got to have a change. So she goes into a decline, like Victorian women are always declining. And Charles, she won't eat, won't come down. And he says, what's wrong? And he says, brilliant passage somewhere in the book, maybe she needs a doctor. And somebody reminds him, yes, but you are a doctor. He says, oh, yes. But he calls in a specialist and says, what's wrong with my wife? And the specialist looks over and he says, nothing. She's bored to death. And he says, how can that be? And he describes the life they lead. And the doctor says, well, I advise you to try something else. So he sells his practice and they move to another town 25 miles away. And Emma is immediately revived. The prospect of new town, new faces, new people. And she's pregnant now, their first and only child, little Berta. And they move. And they move into a house almost exactly like the one they leave, on a square with a few houses, and the rest trail off into the country, and it's hot and it's dusty and full of flies. And she takes to her room and starts looking out the window, and Charles starts to build up his practice, and they have their first supper in a new house, and he drinks his cider, and Belcher says, well, Emma. And Emma says, no, not again. She can't escape, see. But this is where they meet Monsieur Homais, the chemist. And Flaubert puts him in there to really give it to science. Homais is for Voltaire. He's against the church. He's for reason, enlightenment. And there's the priest, the curé in the village, is against Voltaire, is against enlightenment. He's for God. And they have this constant battle. The priest will suggest one thing and Homais will boo. Or Homais will suggest one thing and the priest will suggest the church. And they're always at each other. It's a brilliant dialogue between the two. So the baby is born, and she immediately sends the baby off with a nurse. Doesn't want to be bothered. The chemist, Homais, has a young clerk working for him, Léon, that I told you about. Léon immediately falls in love with Emma, but is too bashful to do anything, to say anything about it. And they meet, and she is playing the piano a little bit, and he recites a little poetry, and they immediately know they are soulmates. But he doesn't know that Emma is hungry for romance, and he's too timid to make any advances, and she won't let him know that she is receptive, so they have this platonic kind of thing between them, and nothing happens. But on the outskirts of the town, in an estate, there lives a wealthy man named Rodolphe, Monsieur Rodolphe, and he's not the least bit timid. And he's in town one day, bringing his servant in to have Charles look at him, and he sees Emma. And he twirls his mustache, and sizes her up and makes these remarks to himself about her: a nice ankle, trim little jaw, like you're talking about a horse. He says, I'll have her. He says, but getting rid of her will be painful. And I mean, already he's going through all these things in his mind, you know, what's going to happen. And sure enough, it happens. That's Monsieur Rodolphe. Yes, three pretty words and she'll adore you, he says. I'll be bound. Tender, charming it would be. Yes, but how to shake it off afterwards. Oh, I'll have her, he shouted, scattering a clod of earth in front of him with a swing of the stick. And that's Flaubert foreshadowing again. The clod of earth, obviously, is Emma. Later on, when she and Rodolphe are meeting at night secretly in an orchard, a ripe peach falls, plop on the ground and bursts, and then they hear a little weasel scurrying in the underbrush. And all these allusions, obviously, Emma is the fat peach falling and Rodolphe is the weasel. But Flaubert does that so gently that a second-rate writer would overwrite, and the symbol would be glaring, but as it is, he just kind of throws it in there, and it's very nice. The big thing that's coming in this village is the agricultural fair. And that means they're going to have all the people from all the outlying districts come in with their sheep and their cows and their garden things, and they're going to put on a big fair. And everybody's getting psyched up for this one. Nothing else is going on in this town. They've got to. And besides, the district representative is sending another functionary with a sash across and a big medal. He's going to give a lecture about growing things and husbandry and all that kind of thing. So they have a platform. You can imagine the scene down the square. They have a platform for the dignitaries, and they're upstairs getting ready for this. They're going to march out together, and the mayor has his top hat on, and the curé has his best vestments on, and Monsieur Homais has some little medal he's won somewhere, and off they go. And Emma doesn't want to get, she's too hot for Emma, so she's going to sit up like in the balcony here and look outside on the square. And who offers to sit with her? Monsieur Rodolphe. And Charles, of course, says, oh, how nice of you to take the time to stay with my wife, Emma. All the way through, he's congratulating Rodolphe. Later on, Rodolphe suggests they go for a ride in the country. And Emma says, oh, I couldn't, really. And Charles says, oh, it'd be just the thing for you. I'll buy you a new riding habit. That decided her. See? Never mind the ethical consideration. It was the riding habit that did it. And then he thanks Rodolphe profusely for taking the time to be with Emma. And Rodolphe all the while has his own ideas. So there they are, sitting up there in the fair going on downstairs in the square. And he brings his chair up next to her. And she's trying not to listen to him. She's trying to watch what's going on. Why inveigh against the passions, he says. Are they not the one beautiful thing there is on earth, the source of all heroism and enthusiasm, poetry, music, art, everything? All the same, said Emma, we must take some notice of what the world thinks and conform to its morality. But you see, there are two moralities, he replied. One is the petty, conventional morality of men, clamorous, ever-changing, that flounders about on the ground of the earth, earthy, like the mob of nincompoops down there. The other, the eternal morality, is all about and above us, like the countryside that surrounds us and the blue heavens that give us light. She starts fanning a little harder. The pulse is beating a little harder. She's not used to hearing this kind of thing. You know, Charles doesn't say this kind of stuff to her when he belches and pats his stomach. Rodolphe had drawn closer to Emma and was talking rapidly in a low voice. Doesn't this conspiracy of society revolt you? Is there a single feeling it does not condemn? The noblest instincts, the purest sympathies are reviled and persecuted. And if ever two poor souls do meet, then everything is organized to prevent their union. They'll attempt it all the same. They'll flap their wings and call to one another. And no matter what happens, sooner or later, in 6 months or 10 years, they'll meet again and love. Because fate ordains it. Because they were born for one another. And her fan is going a little more rapidly. He sat with arms folded on his knees, raising his eyes to Emma's. He gazed at her closely, fixedly. She saw little gleams of gold playing about his dark pupils, etc., etc., etc. Her nostrils dilated rapidly, vigorously, breathing in the freshness of the ivy round the tops of the columns. She took off her gloves, wiped her hands, fanned her face with her handkerchief, while through the throbbing at her temple she could hear the hum of the crowd below and the speaker droning out his sing-song. And now the fair is beginning. And now we have one of the most brilliant passages, I think, in literature, when prizes are being handed out for what's going on in the fair below, and Rodolphe trying to seduce Emma upstairs. Rodolphe had led gradually from magnetism to affinities, and while the chairman alluded to Cincinnatus at his plow, to Diocletian among his cabbages, to the Chinese emperors ushering in the new year with a sowing of seed, the young man was explaining to the young woman that the cause of these irresistible attractions lay in some previous existence. Why now did we meet? What turn of fate decreed it? Was it not that, like two rivers gradually converging across the intervening distance, our own natures propelled us towards one another? He took her hand, and she did not withdraw it. Grand prize! Cried the chairman from the square. Just now, for instance, when I came to call on you. Monsieur Bizet! How could I know that I should escort you here? 70 francs! And I've stayed with you because I couldn't tear myself away, though I've tried 100 times. Manure! From the square. And so I'd stay tonight and tomorrow. I'd stay every day for the rest of my life. To Monsieur Caron, a gold medal! For I had never been so utterly charmed with anyone before. To Monsieur Bain! And so I shall cherish the memory of you. For Merino Ram! But you'll forget me. I shall have passed like a shadow. To Monsieur Bellot of Notre Dame! No, say I shan't. Tell me I shall count for something in your thoughts and your life. Pigs! More manure! Rodolphe squeezed her hand. He felt it warm and vibrant in his, like a captive turtle dove trying to take wing. Whether she was trying to withdraw it or responding to his pressure, her fingers made a movement. Oh, thank you. You do not repulse me, he said. How sweet you are. You know that I am yours. Only let me look at you. Let me gaze upon you. Flax, drainage, long leases, domestic service, Flemish fertilizer. Rodolphe had stopped speaking. They looked at one another, and their dry lips quivered in a supreme desire. Gently, effortlessly, their fingers intertwined. And then the scene goes on with what's going on down below. Brilliant piece of writing, I think. Manure, merino ram, all the while he's doing all these dumb, cliche-ridden things that worked. Well, anyway, he does see her again, and they do go off writing and into this thicket, and they dismount, and he takes her in his arms, and she says, oh, no, we mustn't. And she surrenders, as Flaubert says. And brilliant way to handle, the BBC handled it. The next scene, they're lying on the ground, and she has her blouse open, and it's kind of this dreamy, satisfied look in her eyes. And he's lying next to her, smoking a cigar, mending the bridle. Just, you know, blasé. He's got a piece of straw in his mouth. And she's remarking to herself how now she has joined that company of adulteresses that she's read about. At last, she calls them the sweet sisters of adultery. At last I have joined in all, and she goes on and on. And she tries to say some of this to Rodolphe, and he's, oh yes, what, my dear? Oh, of course, you got to fix this bridle. He's lost interest already after about 15 minutes. Well, this goes on for quite a while until then finally she can't stand it. She has to go to him. So she, when Charles leaves on his round, she gets out and runs across the field, stepping in mud, lifting up her skirt, slipping, getting slapped in the face by branches, stepping in cow pies, and arriving at his, or what did somebody call that on the tour? Ecology Frisbees. That's beautiful. She arrives and he wakes up and says, you, what are you doing here? And she flings herself on the bed and covers him with kisses, and she smells of manure and fresh grass, and it's a beautiful description. And he's kind of amused at this until finally he says, won't Charles find out? And immediately he starts withdrawing this relationship, and she's no way that she wants to have this end. So she says, you must take me away. I must get away from Charles and all this ugly stuff. So he says, oh yes, of course, we'll do that. Tomorrow. And this kind of goes on until she finally puts really pressure on him and says, we've got to get away. So he says to himself, yes, I've got to get away. And he brings his coach around, and he leaves for a while. And he's supposed to come by and pick up Emma. And so she has her bag packed and her trunk's ready to go, and she's got a dress on her hood. And she sees the carriage go by. She's upstairs, and she knows that's him. And off he goes out of town, and she knows that's it. And she gets very dizzy, and it's very hot, and shutters are open, and she looks down, she thinks of jumping, falling to the cement. And she hears the lathe buzzing in the distance. Another great character Flaubert created is Monsieur Binet, who has a lathe. And for him, the lathe is the answer to everything. If you're sick at heart, if you have troubles, get a lathe. There's nothing like standing out there and working with a lathe. In fact, later on, when Léon is lovesick and he's really bawling for Emma, but he can't say anything and he won't eat and he's kind of mooning around, and people say, what's wrong with him? And then Binet, and I think Homé says he needs a physic, and Binet says he needs a lathe. And the curé says he needs God, and they all fight for the souls in the town. Anyway, that's it. But the way he goes, the Dear John letter he sends her is probably something worth just looking at. He says, how can I write a letter to her saying that I'm leaving? And he does write a letter and has a servant take it to her in a basket of fruit. He says, how shall I end it? Let's see. How shall I sign it? You're devoted? No. After having this elaborate affair. Your friend? Yes. No, I can't do that. Poor little woman, he thought, with a movement of pity. She'll think I've a heart of stone. It could have done with a few tears over it. Well, it's not my fault if I can't cry. He poured out a glass of water, dipped his fingers in it, and let one long drop fall on the paper. The ink smudged, and he was satisfied. Oh, what a cad, you know, poor Emma. So she's so shaken by this that she's determined to turn over a new leaf and be a good wife and all, and a good mother to poor Berta and all that. And there's a clubfoot in the village, Hippolyta, who goes around with this kind of ghastly stump-like foot. And it occurs to Emma that it would be a feather in Charles' cap if he could operate and make this foot right. So she starts putting the word to Homé and Monsieur Homé, and then to pressure on Charles. And Charles says, oh, I couldn't do that. It's beyond me. She says, of course you could. Nothing to it. Get out your medical books. So he starts thinking, well, perhaps I could. So he gets out of his medical books and tries to read how you cure this thing, and he just doesn't think he can do it. But she spread the word that it's going to be done, so the whole town gathers for this auspicious occasion in the afternoon when Charles is going to operate on poor Hippolyta. And Charles says, well, I suppose I could do it. So he lays out his meager tools and opens the book, as I'm going to do. Let me see if I can find the page here. And so the town are gathered around, understand. They're out in the square, and Homé is standing at the door as Charles is operating, and every time Charles does something, Homé relays to the crowd. He's picking up an instrument. Now he's putting it down. He's going to his book. No matter what, he's getting a drink of water. And the crowd cheers and rise and fall and murmuring. And poor Charles is sweating, and Emma's pacing back. And there's Hippolyta with his beatific grin on his face, knowing he's going to be saved. Well, on a side table, just as in a hospital, lay a pile of lint, some waxed thread, a heap of bandages, a pyramid of bandages, all the bandages there were in the chemist shop. Monsieur Homé, it was, who had been organizing the event all morning, alike to impress the multitude and to flatter his own conceit. Charles made an incision. They heard a sharp snap. The tendon was cut. The operation was over. Hippolyta, speechless with astonishment, bent over Bovary's hands to cover them with kisses. The tendon snapped. You get the impression that he didn't quite do what he was supposed to do? Well, listen to this. Terrible. And he put his foot in a box-like instrument that he had ordered, some kind of a, with many little doors that open, and he shoved the poor foot in there and then screwed these things all down. He said, now lie still, and that'll be all right. Your foot will be healed. Well, Hippolyta, the next day, was screaming at the top of his lungs, and they all ran in to see what was wrong. He was writhing in frightful convulsions. The machine in which his leg was encased was banging against the wall hard enough to stave it in. Taking every precaution to avoid moving the limb, they withdrew the box and laid bare a hideous sight. The foot was swollen to an unrecognizable shape, and the whole of the skin looked about to burst, and it was covered with patches caused by the wonderful machine. Hippolyta had complained of pain before, but they hadn't taken any notice. Now they were forced to admit that he had not been entirely in the wrong, and he was freed for a few hours. No sooner had the edema subsided a little, however, than the two experts saw fit to replace the limb in the apparatus, clamping it in still tighter to hurry things along. After another 3 days, Hippolyta being at the end of his tether, They again removed the contraption and were astonished at the sight that met their eyes. A livid tumor had spread right up the leg, with pustules here and there discharging a dark liquid. Things had taken a serious turn. Hippolyta was beginning to lose heart. Charles advised light meals. And that's as much as he can advise. He doesn't know what else to do. So the gangrene had indeed spread higher and higher. It made Bovary feel ill himself. He called in every hour, every minute. Hippolyta looked up at him with terror-stricken eyes. "When am I going to get better?" he sobbed. "Make me well. It's awful, it's awful." The doctor always advised light meals. Eventually, they had to call in the surgeon again, and the surgeon took one look at this and said, "What in the hell did you do to this man?" And Charles says, "Well, I made this incision." And the surgeon said, "Get out." And they had to amputate poor Hippolyta's leg. And then he was fitted with an artificial leg and a stump, which he stumped around for the rest of his life. And every time he saw the doctor on the square, he would always run over and kiss Charles' hand for what you've given me this leg, he said. Hippolyta wasn't very bright. And then Charles always feels, he couldn't accept this, you know. At least was his own leg, gnarled as it was. Well, this poor Emma now is really shattered. She says, "You've done this. You can't even do a simple thing like this." So she's really down on Charles now, as it was bad enough before. Well, she goes into another decline to hurry the story along. And Charles says, "I've got to get her out of this." And that's when he takes her to Rouen for an opera. They're going to go to an opera. And they're sitting in the box, enjoying the opera. And who should be in the next box? Léon. And Léon now is a young man who's studying for the law. Remember, he's a little more sophisticated. He's coming up in the world. He's making some money. And he and Emma meet, and immediately she swept off her feet again. And that's when they make up this pretense of taking piano lessons in Rouen. Charles goes back. He insists that Emma stay in Rouen for a couple of days. She's, "Oh, Charles, I couldn't really. You really think I should?" "It'd be good for you." And Léon says, "Oh, it'll be great for you." She says, "I bet it will." And meanwhile, Charles is thanking Léon profusely, just as he thanked Rodolphe for taking her horseback riding. He's thanking Léon for all this. Well, they carry out this affair for a long time. Interestingly enough, there's a great section here. They meet in a cathedral. And Flaubert is at pains to describe the interior of the cathedral. And they come out of the cathedral, and she says, "We've got to call this off." And she's written him a little note where they're not going to meet anymore. "I'm going to go home to Charles and be a good wife and see my daughter and all this kind of thing." And he says, "Well, let's take a ride in this cab and think about it." She says, no, "I've made up my mind. It's over." He says, "Well, let's just take a little ride." So they get in this cab, and the cabbie says, "Where to?" And he says, "Anywhere you like, just drive on." And he pulls the curtains down. And it's a great description. The cab just rattles off past this street, past that street, over this bridge, around this square. And pretty soon it comes back again to where it started, and over the bridge and around the square, and up the hill and down the hill. And this goes on for 4 hours till finally a hand is seen at this window, and some little papers is torn up and flown out. It's a great description. People stand in awe and wonder why this carriage is rocketing through these streets and banging at the side of the house, and the poor coachman is mopping his brow and beating the horses. 4 hour drive in this carriage. And that's the last of Emma's resolution right there. Well, things are not going well, as you might imagine. She's spending money like crazy, and where she and his practice is not doing well. So where is she getting the money? From a really nasty guy, Monsieur Leroux, who sells dry goods. And he's always trying to get her to buy things on credit. She says, "I haven't any money." He says, "Don't worry about money. A doctor's wife is always good for it. We'll settle later. I wouldn't have you think about money." Well, you know how that goes. You don't think about it. Pretty soon, a year later, a staggering bill. And he just kind of drops a hint once in a while. "My goodness, I wonder if your husband knows the bill is that large." She says, "Well, don't bother him with it." He says, "Oh, of course I wouldn't think of bothering the doctor. Of course, we should settle up some way." She says, "What do you mean, some way?" He says, "Well, I think we could maybe work out something." Oh, and the hand reaches out for her little knee, and she's just reviled by this guy. But he starts putting the screws down a little tighter, and Léon has dropped her because, guess why, poor Emma There's a great section there where he's in his rooms in Rouen, and he's remember the section I told you about, he's running his hand over her petticoat, wondering whether he loved her petticoat or her soul more. And she's looking out the window, and she says she's discovered in adultery all the banality of marriage. What a damning statement. Discovering in adultery all the banality of marriage. Even in an affair, after Rodolphe and Nalion, she still hasn't discovered the pizzazz she thought she was looking for, in all the books. And Léon, it was discovered by one of the people in the law office that he was seeing this married woman. And word got to him, listen, buddy, if you want to join our firm, watch out. So when it comes to passion or respectability, respectability will win out every time, right? So he drops Emma. Well, she can't stand this. How dare you do that? He's, well, after all, I have my career, and his cravat and his starched collar, and he's got a mustache now, and he's a man of means. You can't be seen doing things like this. And so she's so distraught. She owes money, and she doesn't know what to do. She's decided to end it all, so she runs back to Charles, goes into Monsieur Homais' shop, bursts in the back door, grabs the key that unlocks the poison cabinet, rams her hand in a jar, says arsenic on it, and crams a big handful in her mouth. Romantic to the end. And within a short time, she's in convulsions and spitting blood, and the end is really not pretty. But you've got to hear it, because part of it, because it's in keeping with what Flaubert is doing in the whole book. She is really dying. Drops of sweat stood on her blue-veined face, which looked as if it had been petrified by exposure to some metallic vapor. Her teeth chattered, her pupils were dilated, her eyes stared vaguely about her. To every question she responded simply with a shake of her head. Two or three times she smiled. And poor Charles, of course, is beside himself, wondering what he can do, which is nothing. Not long afterwards, she started vomiting blood. Her lips pressed tighter together, her limbs writhed, the brown spots broke out of her body, her pulse slid between the fingers like a taut wire, like a harp string about to snap. She began to scream horribly. She damned and cursed the poison, begged it to be quick, and with her stiffening arms pushed away everything that Charles, in still worse agony than she, kept trying to make her drink. The chemist comes in, the priest comes in, Monsieur Binet can't get his lathe in, but he's there, wondering what to do, till finally the curé says it's hopeless, she's going, we've got to give her the last rites. This section is just, let's read it. The priest rose to take the crucifix, reaching forward like one in thirst, she glued her lips to the body of the man God, and laid upon it with all her failing strength the most mighty kiss of love she'd ever given. The priest recited the mass, then dipped his right thumb into the oil and began the unctions, first on the eyes that had coveted all earthly splendors, then on the nostrils that had loved warm breezes and amorous perfumes, then on the mouth that had opened for falsehood, had grown with pride and cried out in lust, then on the hands that had reveled in delicious contacts, lastly on the soles of the feet that once had run so swiftly to the assuaging of her desires and now would walk no more. Flaubert really lets her have it with that passage, those last rites, and she dies. Poor Charles is so distraught. The daughter, Berta, is sent to live with an aunt. Charles is walking around like one asleep. Terrible section where they're sitting up with the body. Monsieur Homais and the curé, and the curé lights candles. Monsieur Homais douses the room with a cleanser. And they glare at each other and fall asleep. Charles comes forward to try to take a lock of her hair, can't do it. The chemist says, I'll do it, stumbles, cuts her skin in several places. Charles runs out screaming, and they bury her. Several days later, Rodolphe, of course, has heard about this and has stayed away. Several days later, Charles accidentally comes across a box of letters, love letters from Rodolphe, and realizes the truth that Rodolphe and Emma were indeed lovers. And he meets Rodolphe, and he looks across the table over the beer at Rodolphe, and instead of hitting him in the mouth, he envies Rodolphe and wishes he were that man. This is the way the book concludes. And Rodolphe, of course, can't believe that any man could be like this, and goes away and in shame and disbelief. Next day, Charles went to sit out on the bench in the arbor. Sunlight streamed into the trellis. The vine leaves traced their shadows on the gravel. Jasmine scented the air. The sky was blue. Bumblebees buzzed around the lilies in flower. Charles felt suffocated like a young man by the vague currents of love that swelled his stricken heart. At 7 o'clock, Berta, who had not seen him all afternoon, came to fetch him into dinner. His head was thrown back against the wall. His eyes were closed. His mouth was open. And in his hand, he held a long tress of black hair. "Come on, Daddy," she said. And thinking he was having a game with her, she gave him a push. He fell to the ground. He was dead. 36 hours later, in answer to the chemist's request, Monsieur Canavet arrived. He opened up the body, but found nothing. There's that brilliant Flaubert battle axe again. He opened up the body and found nothing. When everything had been sold up, there was a balance of 12 francs and 25 centimes, which paid for Mademoiselle Bovary's journey to her grandmother's. That good lady died within the year, and the little girl was then taken in by an aunt. Since Bovary's death, three doctors have followed one another at Yonville without success. So rapid and determined has been Homais's onslaught upon them. His practice grows like wildfire. Authority respects and public opinion protects him. He has just been awarded the Legion of Honor. And that's the way Flaubert ends the book. After all these characters have come and gone and done all the various things they do, it is Monsieur Homais, reason, enlightenment, who this bourgeois boob, of all bourgeois boobs, he out-Babbitts Babbitt, he receives the Legion of Honor. And as I said when asked, who is really Emma Bovary? Emma Bovary, c'est moi. Thanks for coming.